last time I took a road trip? How many national parks could I hit in 2 weeks? What about hotels? Wait, hey, Erica, how much am I spending on travel?
When your questions about life turn into questions about money, there's Erica, the virtual financial assistant to help you spend, save, and plan smarter. Only from Bank of America. What would you like the power to do? Erica is only available in the English language. You must download the latest version of the mobile banking app, only available on select mobile devices. Your chat may be recorded and monitored for quality assurance. Message and data rates and additional terms may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to The Rest Is Money with me, Steph McGovern.
And with me, Robert Peston.
So we have got something a bit different for you this week, haven't we? Because we are going to do a bit of a mini-series on what our Robert describes as the most frightening financial event in recent history. And this is all to do with the UK's government bond crisis of 2022. That is a pretty scary statement, Robert. What's your vibe? Because, I mean, I worked with you on the 2008 banking crisis and that felt scary, but you think what was happening then, 2022 to now, has been scarier, don't you?
I do, in a UK context. Obviously, the 2007-8 global banking crisis was, you know, in a global context, the worst financial crisis since at least the 1930s. But I was more anxious in the autumn of 2022. And the reason for that is because at the heart of the crisis were decisions made by the government and also actions taken by the Bank of England. And those are the two sort of groups of people you would expect to keep us safe. And they were driving us towards the cliff edge. And that's why I found this incident at the time terrifying.
Right. So over the course of three episodes, we're going to take you through how it was allowed to happen, who's to blame, and what it means now. And the key thing that I think you want people to know from all of this is different from what everyone thinks they know about that time, isn't it?
Yeah, for me, this feels like unfinished business. The widespread view that this was purely the incompetence of the then Prime Minister Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng, the recklessness of their mini-budget decisions. I was never totally happy at the time with that explanation. And so I have been engaging for months now, actually, in interviewing people, effectively an investigation, a more complete version of what happened and who was to blame. And the reason this matters, and the reason I'm slightly upset we don't yet have a proper version of it, is this was history. This financial crisis was, in my view, the cause of why Liz Truss was the shortest-lived prime minister in history. This was not just a financial crisis, it was a constitutional crisis. And weirdly, it has been totally underreported. The country sort of moved on. And I'm never happy, as an OCD individual, as you know, I'm never happy not having the answers. And so what we're going to try and do today, I hope, you know, we're not on this yet, we won't have all the answers, but I think we'll have a more complete picture at the end of this mini-series of what happened, and as I say, who was to blame. And I hope that listeners will learn that perhaps some of the things they thought was true about this and who they thought was to blame, that's not quite right. We've actually got some more culprits here.
So I'm just going to break it up and tell you what you're going to get from each episode. So in this one, we're going to explain what was going on in the world at the time, what the plan was to kind of navigate through it, who the people were behind the scenes, kind of getting us through all this. And in particular, we're going to talk about the vulnerability in the bond market that hadn't been taken into account. And that is where the crux of this is. The second episode, we're going to look at what the Bank of England did about it and why that caused more problems. And, you know, we'll wrap things up looking at where it left us and what it all means
now. And can I just interject there? What we're going to look at is not just what the Bank of England did right, but also what it got desperately wrong.
Yes, exactly. So let me just give you the economic context then of the time. So we're talking September 2022. Things were really tough. You know, inflation was around 10%. A lot of this to do with energy prices, of course, what was going on in Ukraine and Russia. Energy prices had completely ramped up. It plunged us into this massive cost of living crisis. So this was a problem across the world. It wasn't just a UK issue, what was going on with inflation. And interestingly, we actually looked a bit better than some other countries at the time because the rate of interest paid by the UK government had for a long time been lower than that paid by countries like the US. So we actually looked like we were going to get through this all right, didn't we?
It was a bit unclear. We'd had, as you know, a leadership contest for the candidate to replace Boris Johnson, both as leader of the Tory party and prime minister. Liz Truss had emerged victorious. She had said during that summer that she was going to take more, to use the phrase fiscal risk. She talked about the imperative of cutting taxes. And actually, as it looked as though she was going to win, and indeed in the early days of her premiership, the amount that the government had to pay to borrow started to rise. And it started to rise really quite sharply. Because investors were looking at the UK and at that stage were saying, with Liz Truss, there are going to be these financial risks. So even before the so-called mini budget, the fiscal financial backdrop was deteriorating. And you're absolutely right. For years, up until she became leader, the UK was paying less to borrow than the American government was. And that was for a variety of reasons. One of the reasons for that is just growth in the UK was so low, partly because of Brexit. But when she starts talking about the need to slash taxes to boost growth, but also has no plan to show how she's going to finance those tax cuts, international investors begin to get anxious. That interest rate starts to rise and starts to rise really quite sharply.
Yeah, and I want to come back to all of that. So just to kind of recap, there's been loads of, we're in this turmoil, there's been loads of drama in terms of leadership. As you say, Boris Johnson resigned, Truss has come in after a battle with Rishi. 2 days after she gets the job, the Queen dies. But can you, before we go into then what happened, give us a sense of like who Liz Truss is, what kind of character she is, because she's someone who wants to shake up the status quo.
Certainly not what you would call a conventional politician. She is unbelievably determined, incredibly ambitious, thick-skinned like no politician I've ever come across. And to use that cliche, she's been on something of a political journey. We've all seen that video of her as a student at the Lib Dem conference, right at the start of her political life, as it were, when she's standing on the podium of the Lib Dems calling for the abolition of the monarchy. I mean, who thought that at the moment that, you know, Queen Elizabeth dies, she would be on the throne? And in fact, it's quite clear there's been a leak of this book that she's just published, or she's just about to publish, excuse me. And I have to say, in her dying days, it's quite clear from Liz Truss's book that the Queen got the measure of Liz Truss, because Liz Truss does this extraordinary, actually some would say slightly unconstitutional thing, of revealing what the Queen said to her in a private audience. And the Queen said to Liz Truss, you know, don't rush things, take it easy. Don't, you know, you can't achieve everything at once. And I have to say, hats off to her, the late Her Majesty, as it were. Yeah. That has always been, some would say, the critique that people would make of Liz Truss, which is when she's certain she's right, okay, there is not a scintilla of doubt about what she wants to do. It's almost impossible to knock her off that position. And my goodness, she goes for it.
Can we talk about her, what she thought about the Bank of England? Because she was never really a fan, was she? And while the governor of the Bank of England was blaming the Ukraine-Russian war for inflation and interest rates being high, Truss was suggesting, wasn't she, that actually this was partly the bank's fault that rates were so high. And this was, you know, she had a pop at Carney saying it was them for years not handling things properly with interest rates. Yes.
So she, her position on the Bank of England, you know, has been a bit confused. You know, during the leadership election, she seemed to suggest that she wanted really fundamental reforms. But I have to say that what she had to say, particularly about learning from Japan, most of us didn't quite think made any sense. She said some things that implied that she wasn't in favour of the independence of the Bank of England, that independence which Gordon Brown had given them in 1997, and then seemed to row back and seemed to say that she was in favour of independence. She did make, in my view, and those around her like Kwasi Kwarteng, they made some perfectly reasonable points about the failures of the Bank of England to take action early enough to curb inflation. You earlier made the point that the big boost to inflation came from Putin's invasion and the surge in energy prices. But it is also, frankly, the case, and this is something the Bank of England simply got wrong, was that the huge monetary stimulus during COVID, that's quantitative easing, massive purchases of government bonds, that led to greater inflationary pressures. And some would argue that the last phase of quantitative easing by the Bank of England was a mistake. The supply chain shocks that we had as we came out of the COVID crisis, that is when there was such a surge in demand for goods and, you know, tankers couldn't get to the right places on time and we had terrible trouble just getting the goods that we needed, that caused an inflationary shock. The shortage of labor because of COVID, that caused an inflationary shock. This wasn't just about energy prices. And the Bank of England, frankly, just did not appreciate the extent to which, even without Ukraine, there was inflation building in the system. So I think that criticism of the Bank of England, which people like Truss and on the right of politics were making, that was a perfectly reasonable criticism of the Bank of England.
So let's bring now into the picture, you've just mentioned him, Kwasi Kwarteng as well. Give us his vibe and kind of their dynamics.
Kwasi Kwarteng is, in one sense, is a lot like Liz Truss, which is, again, he has an astonishing self-confidence. I mean, she went to a comprehensive in Leeds, right? But she obviously had parents who doted on her academics, lefty parents. He goes to Eton, regarded as quite an accomplished historian. He's written some books that people on the whole rate. But look, truthfully, doesn't know that much about economics. I mean, quite a lot of chancellors haven't known that much about economics, but here he is, given the second biggest job in the country. She has a plan. He agrees effectively to implement that plan. And they both decide that they basically know best. And they both have this view, but this is particularly Liz Truss's view, that there is this establishment mindset within Whitehall, what some people on the right of politics refer to as the mindset of the so-called blob. I think this was a phrase that normally associated originally in terms of invention with Michael Gove, and that the so-called blob would always block radical change. And they were determined, you know, they made one very correct diagnosis, which is the UK economy had not been growing for years. And it is very hard to generate tax revenues with a flat economy. And if you, you know, then their view was, we need, in a sense, to give electric shock treatment to the British economy to get it moving again. They weren't prepared to listen to anybody who might make the argument that the problem with electric shock therapy is there's always a risk you kill the patient.
Coming back to this blob then, God, I would hate to be referred to as a blob. Wouldn't that be so insulting? Part of the blob was this guy called Tom Scholar, who they got rid of with it. I mean, Liz got rid of him within a few days of being Prime Minister, and he was the guy who was the permanent secretary to the Treasury. He'd been there for about 6 years, I think, hadn't he? But you tell us a bit about who he was and why that this was an important sign in all of this.
Being the top civil servant at the Treasury, that's an enormously powerful role, okay? I mean, arguably, there are times when being permanent secretary of the Treasury makes you the most powerful civil servant. Technically, the cabinet secretary is your boss, but you know, the Treasury is the most important government department by a country mile. That is, if you're an ambitious civil servant, that's the job you want. Tom Scholar, classic Whitehall Mandarin. His dad was a permanent secretary. He'd done really big jobs for David Cameron when he was prime minister. He was in that you know, established tradition. He was a very safe pair of hands within, he was considered within Whitehall. But Liz Truss viewed him as a probable obstacle to reform. Now, those close to Liz Truss say that the reason that she wanted to get rid of him had a personal element, that she felt she was for a period the second most powerful minister at the Treasury. It's a role called Chief Secretary to the Treasury. She felt, I am told, that he disrespected her, that he just didn't rate her.
So that's some of the characters. I know we're going to obviously bring in the Bank of England in a minute in all of this as well. We're going to come to what was in the mini budget in a moment. But what were advisors saying to you about this mini budget and the run up to it?
So I remember going into Downing Street before the mini budget and seeing some of my closest advisors. And you could just sense the anxiety around the place. Because, you know, we were talking about the, you know, the UK's growth challenge, and they used phrases like, believe me, Robert, you are not going to feel we're being timid here. And although they were simply executing the will of the Prime Minister, they were anxious about it, right?
What did you think when you were hearing them like that? What was it making you think?
I mean, truthfully, I was, you know, the stuff I was reporting, I was thinking, you know, this is going to be a roller coaster. I mean, you have to also put this against the extraordinary backdrop of, you know, the Queen dying. Because Liz Truss gets elected, we know she's going to do these radical things, and then the Queen dies, right? Now, at that point, all normal political and indeed economic reporting is suspended. And so, in a way, she's breaking through the civil service obstacles to anything radical that she might want to do, sacking Tom Scholar, for example. That is an almost unique event, okay? He is supposed to be the guardian of the public finances, right? And it's an incredibly important job. And just giving him the boot before this enormous so-called fiscal event, this mini budget, these tax cuts, you know, at that point, you're telling the world that you are prepared to be, you know, in a sense, bolder than any Chancellor and Prime Minister have been before. And at that point, you're already spooking investors. The normal role of the press to probe, challenge, question in the run-up to the mini budget, that's all suspended because the Queen has died. And so all that's going on at that moment is reporting this, a nation in mourning.
So, I mean, you've painted that picture amazingly of the drama at the time. So let's talk about what was then in this mini budget and the reaction that we had to it. So Kwasi Kwarteng made the speech to Parliament on the 23rd of September. And so in it, he was setting out the most radical package of tax cuts for the UK since the 1970s. So what we had in it, just to give you a little mini summary. So it was scrapping the top rate of income tax, reversing a plan to increase corporation tax, cancelling an increase in a national insurance, tens of billions of pounds of subsidies for energy bills, bringing forward the planned cut in the basic rate of income tax from 20% to 19%. There were all these tax cuts, but no information on how to pay for them, other than them saying it was going to mean the country borrowing £45 billion.
Extra. And let's just put that into some context. OK, so that means that's unfunded tax cuts, £45 billion, funded by debt, right? And this comes after the biggest rise ever in borrowing because of COVID in peacetime. And so we've got debt in the UK, depending on how you measure it, but roughly 100% of national income, of GDP. You know, these are the biggest debt levels that the UK has had outside of war. Okay, now, this is true. This is a global phenomenon. But when you've had such a big rise in borrowing, which we had for years, much of it to do with COVID, inevitably in those circumstances, investors begin to ask, how are you going to pay the debt back? So when you then have a chancellor who's saying we're going to borrow even more against a backdrop where in the rest of the world, governments are saying, okay, this is a moment perhaps to consolidate and tighten your belts. At that point, the UK looks a particularly risky bet. The way that global financial markets work, I always like this analogy, it's what I came up with during the financial crisis, is it's an ugly contest, right? The way to make big money if you're an investor is to bet against the ugliest country in the room, the country with the weakest finances. And the problem that Kwarteng and Truss had set for themselves and the whole UK was they were deliberately making a decision, in the view of investors, make the UK the financially weakest of all the big Western economies. They were basically saying to investors, bet against us, it's a surefire bet, which at the time I thought to myself, this is absolutely nuts. Mm. But it turned out to be even more nuts for reasons that we'll get onto.
And another part of this nut story is their refusal to bring in the OBR to assess the implications of their plans as well. The OBR, of course, you know, whenever a budget is delivered, you always get at the start, don't you, the Chancellor talking about what the OBR figures are for predictions for growth and all that kind of thing. But they didn't let the OBR see that. They didn't want them involved at all, did they? Because they mistrusted them. They thought they were part of the blob.
They thought the OBR weren't up to the job, that they thought the OBR's forecasts were consistently bad, and that the OBR conditioned government policy against taking the steps that were needed to promote growth. And they had this belief, and we should at least give their story. They had this belief that if you cut taxes, you spark growth, and over time, the taxes get paid for because the economy is growing faster, there's more activity, more people pay taxes, and over time, the tax cuts pay for themselves. Now, the problem is most economists would say that's a load of old rubbish, that there will always be a gap. Even if you take the view that tax cuts spur growth, they will not totally generate the growth that eliminates the borrowing. That if you want to have tax cuts, and we can see this, and we'll come back to Jeremy Hunt later in the series, but Jeremy Hunt takes the view you can't have tax cuts unless you shrink the state, unless you shrink public spending. Even if you are one of those economists who say you got to have, you know, some unfunded tax cuts, it is too risky to have the scale of unfunded tax cuts that they had. And they had no plans at that stage to shrink the public sector, which is why, for investors, this was felt to be ludicrously risky.
So we have all of these unfunded tax cuts, and suddenly the country looks like it's not good for the money anymore. And then that makes it more expensive for the government to borrow money. And just to explain this, when a government is not bringing in enough money from taxes to cover spending, it has to borrow money. And they do that by selling government bonds, what are called gilts. And it's basically a loan, and lots of countries do this. So an investor will give the government money. In return, they get a guarantee they're going to get this money back plus interest. And how much interest they get is based on how likely it is that government is going to be able to pay back the money. So when this mini budget was announced, it suddenly looked like we weren't good for the money. That made it more expensive then for the government to actually borrow money. And also, more importantly, it made us less attractive to investors as well, which caused chaos for the pension funds, which is another key part of this story, which we're going to come back to. But what were people telling you about then, this turmoil in this bond markets and the gilt markets? Because I remember in 2007, 2008, honestly, your phone was just wild. And every time you put the phone down, you had like another amazing reaction and piece of information from someone who was raging about what was going on. How did this compare? What was happening with your phone?
I was receiving texts and phone calls from people running big financial institutions, and also indeed from quite a lot of MPs, particularly, it has to be said, Tory MPs and indeed former Tory ministers, who at this point were getting very, very anxious. So if I just talk to you about a conversation I had with somebody who runs a very significant UK financial institution, the things that they raised with me were how anxious they were about the sacking of Scholar, how that anxiety had been massively heightened by Kwarteng's refusal to get the Office for Budget Responsibility to assess the consequences of his actions. And they all knew why that was. It's because the OBR would have said to Kwarteng that this will not generate enough growth to cover the costs of these tax cuts. And we haven't even talked about the massive, you know, tens and tens of billions of pounds that were also being borrowed for energy subsidies, right? This was on top of all the other tax cuts, as it were. So this was a period of a massive explosion of borrowing. And the way that they, which is government of Truss and Kwarteng, were sticking two fingers up to the institutions that were there to prevent reckless behavior was a huge shock to the system. So you had this rise in the run-up to the mini budget in the interest rate that the government has to pay. That's the yield you've been talking about on gilts. You then get a modest rise, I mean, still significant by historical standards, on the Friday of the mini budget. On the Sunday, Kwasi Kwarteng goes on the BBC and talks about this is just the start. There are going to be even more tax cuts. And then on the Monday, oh my God, the gilt market just, both the sterling collapses and the gilt market just goes into meltdown. And it's at that point that I get calls from city institutions telling me that this is not any longer just about investors in the normal way punishing the government, but there is a genuine financial crisis underway that has a different cause.
So this is a hidden vulnerability in the system that made things worse. And we're going to tell you what that is after this break.
Oh, such a clutch pickup, Dave.
I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
I meant those blackout motorized shades.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. I installed these and then got some for my mom, too. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Hall of Fame son.
They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
Go to Blinds.com for up to 40% off. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
So welcome back to The Rest is Money with me, Robert Peston.
And me, Steph McGovern. So we're going to go back into our mini-series of the chaos of the UK bond markets in 2022. And just before the break, I mentioned there about this hidden vulnerability in the system that made things worse. And this is all to do with pensions and in particular final salary pension schemes on the whole. So just to remind you all on that, it's a workplace pension. It provides you with a guaranteed annual income for life based on your final or your average salary. Now, the bulk of money in these schemes is invested in government bonds because they are seen as the safest kind of investment, aren't they? Because of course, this is, you know, we're talking about people's income when they retire. There's another reason as well why government bonds are particularly attractive to pension schemes too, isn't there, Robert?
Yeah, well, there were some regulatory changes donkey's years ago which forced pension funds to assess today's value, the present value of their liabilities. That's the pensions they're going to have to pay out in the future in relation to the income that they can get from government bonds. So there is this weird dynamic, and it is a genuinely weird dynamic. And if you're listening to this, I hope your brain doesn't explode about this because you will think that the regulation of pensions is mad. But there is this weird dynamic that when government bonds fall in value, that is good for the health of pension funds because it means that the interest rate they receive from government bonds is higher. And that interest rate, that yield, is the so-called discount rate that is applied all these future payments that they have to make to pensioners. And the higher the discount, the lower the value of the liability in today's money. But the reason that your brain will explode when I tell you this is because although that is an accounting reality, if you actually hold those bonds, which these pension funds do, the actual value of those bonds has in today's money fallen. Okay? But the reason in a way that doesn't matter to them is because the pension funds would hold those bonds to maturity. And so today's price isn't that important because in the end of the day, they're going to get back 100 pence in the pound from the government. Okay, so the fact that in today's money they're taking a capital hit doesn't matter on their main books, but, and this is what we're going to get onto, the problem for the pension funds is that they actually borrowed on the short-term debt market that's known as the bank repo market to buy colossal amounts of these bonds through what are known as LDI funds.
Yep.
And you're going to tell us a little bit now about what these LDI funds are.
Yeah. So an LDI is a liability-driven investment fund. So it's a type of investment fund that's typically owned by a final salary pension scheme, as Robert was just saying. Now, obviously, the aim of this fund is to make money to pay for the financial obligations of the pension fund when they become due. But they are what you call leverage funds. So they're in a load of debt, basically. They borrow money to buy the gilts.
And they buy it from the what's called the repo market on the whole. And that is a very short-term lending market, which is provided essentially by all the sort of banks you'd have heard.
Yeah. And the gilts that they buy are actually the collateral for this debt as well. So, I mean, the way I think about it is, if you buy a house, you borrow money to buy a house, don't you? And if you can't afford to pay back your debt, your house is repossessed. So in the case of LDIs, you borrow money to buy the gilts. And then if anything happens to the gilts, which are now your assets, then the bank would want them back if things go wrong. And what happened is things went wrong.
Spectacularly.
Yes.
Right? And so what's happening is, both in the run-up to the mini-budget and then subsequently, the price of government bonds is falling, which means that the collateral, the security underpinning these debts that the LDI funds have taken on is falling. And the banks who've lent all this money to the LDI funds are saying to the LDI funds, we are going to seize these assets, we are going to seize these gilts and then sell them unless you give us more collateral, more security. So the LDI funds at that point either have to get assets from the pension funds to put into their funds, or they have to get cash from the pension funds. And if they don't, then the banks seize the gilts and sell them.
And what is different from buying a house and your house getting repossessed is that takes a long time. There's negotiation, there's process. But with an LDI, the bank just takes the gilts off you straight away.
That's totally right. So let's just talk about, again, these phone calls I'm getting from people in the market. You know, on the Monday and the Tuesday, after the mini budget, which is on a Friday, I'm getting calls from unbelievably powerful people in the city basically saying, this is a nightmare. This is a meltdown. The government and the Bank of England don't seem to know what's going, you know, how serious this is. Basically, you know, the banks are poised literally this second to take control of these LDI funds and simply dump these bonds on the market. And at this point, the fall, as I say, in the government bond prices, in gilt prices, becomes a rout.
Yeah, and it's worth saying as well, just in terms of the context of, you know, how much money and things we're talking about here, if you look at this time, September 22, around 60% of UK final salary or defined benefit pension schemes invested £1 trillion in LDI funds. So we are talking a lot of money.
This is £1 trillion worth of debt. This is massive.
Yeah, absolutely huge. So why didn't anyone notice? Did the Bank of England not realise this might happen?
After the financial crisis of 2008-09, the Bank of England is given much wider responsibilities to police not only the banks, but also the wider financial markets. It is the duty of the Bank of England to assess and protect us against just these sorts of shocks. A whole new bit of the bank was actually created to do this. And there's a there's this monetary policy committee that sets interest rates. There is also a financial policy committee that meets and produces reports that are supposed to assess whether or not the financial system is at risk. And if it is at risk, the Bank of England is supposed to protect us. And so the really big question, which we will get onto, I think, in the next episode, is why didn't the Bank of England see this crisis coming? How did it let this vulnerability build and build and build? And just to be clear, just as a taster for what we're going to get onto in the next episode, this is not the case that nobody knew about this. There was a rather brilliant piece in retrospect, actually written by a financial analyst called Toby Nangle in, I think, July of 2022. So literally just weeks before this crisis, he is seeing what's happening to the price of gilts falling. He is seeing the rise of inflation, the rise of interest rates everywhere. And he says there is this trillion plus LDI fund market. And he says that the banks will be starting to demand more collateral, that they will be putting pressure on the LDI funds to provide more collateral. And this is essentially a piece warning of the looming crisis, right? It's in the FT, you know, the paper of record for the city and indeed for the Bank of England, you know. And equally, to be clear, I've also talked to other players in the market who told me that before the mini budget, as I say, banks are asking the LDIs, that banks are getting worried about the health of LDIs, and they are saying we need more collateral, we need more assets. And if we don't, we're going to wind you up. So this is a looming crisis.
So it was there in black and white, or should I say actually black and pink, if you're talking about the FT, that there's a big problem here. And as you say, people are calling you about it. Kwasi Kwarteng and Liz Truss not know about this either? Was anyone telling them that they, you know, their plans for tax cuts and the devaluing of government bonds could also bring down the whole economy because of these LDIs?
So just to be clear, obviously I've talked to both Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng recently about all of this, and they both say until the Monday after the mini budget, to use a technical phrase, they didn't have a Scooby. They literally nobody. Had ever mentioned the LDI market to them. They'd never heard of it. I mean, they're like ordinary citizens. No, I mean, who listening to this podcast will have heard of this enormous, this is one of the sort of weird things about the city. You can have these enormous markets that affect our prosperity, yeah, and nobody's ever heard of them. And certainly neither Kwasi Kwarteng or Liz Truss were told anything about the LDIs and the vulnerability to the whole UK economy and indeed to the government finances until after the mini budget. The Bank of England didn't tell them anything about it, and the Treasury didn't tell them anything about it. And I think worse than that, okay, as I understand it, the Treasury itself was kept in the dark about it until the Monday after the mini budget. Something else we just need to dig into a bit is, you know, had anybody known, had Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng known about this vulnerability, would they have behaved differently? So that is something else we need to get into.
So as things stand then, Robert, we are in chaos. We are heading for disaster. And this is when the Bank of England step in. And we're going to explain, aren't we, in the next episode, what it is they do and how that eventually led to the downfall of Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng.
Yeah, so from the Monday, it is action stations at the Bank of England, and they do put in place a rescue. But the really important point about that rescue is the way that they structured it, maybe not in an economic sense, but my goodness, it created a political crisis. And we're going to talk all about that.
Yes, and that will be in our next episode on Monday. So do watch out for that. We'll see you then. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.